You are listening to Studying Pixels, a podcast on game studies and video game culture. I'm Stefan Heinrich Simond. I'm a game studies scholar from Germany.
I'm Dan Hughes, a Japanese scholar from Texas.
And you can find us every Sunday on studyingpixels.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Should we shun Hogwarts Legacy? That is the question that we're going to debate on this episode, and we're going to start with some opening statements just to stake our position, which might change over the course of this show. But everyone should just know where we stand. Dan, do you want to get us started? What are your thoughts? Do you think we should shun Hogwarts Legacy?
Good question. So this is something I've been thinking about for a while, and it's always hard for me to answer the question, should we shun this piece of art that has been created by so many people? And sometimes it's easier than others when the people involved are all of one mind on a particularly frustrating topic. In this case, we're talking about trans rights, trans issues, and transphobia. And I think that my instinct is to say, yes, we should shun this because of the connection to J.K. Rowling and her ideas. It's benefiting her, it's propagating her. But then I think about all those people who make the game, and I think about certain statements that they've put out, and I think, okay, well, they're not J.K. Rowling, so I don't think we should shun the game. We should be critical of it. And my hope is that this may be a step in taking Harry Potter back for the people who love it, and a step in the direction of death of the author for J.K. Rowling, which is very hard to do while the author is still alive.
Yeah, just kill the author, you know?
It's
that simple.
We should be very clear, in a literary sense, in a critical theory sense.
Yes, this is a theoretical concept. We're not calling for violence, specifically not doing that. Please, as Jim Stephanie Sterling once used to say on a Jimquisition, don't fucking do that.
Yes. So there, we're very clear there. Death of the author in the sense that it's just the narrative, not the author and her intentions here.
Yes. Some Roland Barthes, right?
Yes, yes.
Mm, okay, some French literary theory.
Always happy to bring it in.
I would also say no. We should not shun Hogwarts Legacy. This is only an opening statement, so again, positions might change. We're going to look into everything and explore everything in detail in just a moment. But yeah. I think, just from the way I ascertain the situation right now, that in a utilitarian sense, it is more important that people can engage in their passion of Harry Potter, especially if that involves a game that allows the creation of and the representation of trans identities. So including the idea of trans identities into the fiction and the lore of Harry Potter, that seems to me more important than to, let's say, deprive or try to deprive J.K. Rowling of a very marginal amount of money, considering the amount of money that she already has. So that's why I think we should not shun Hogwarts Legacy. We're going to go into detail on all of these matters, but before we do that, we've got two brief items of housekeeping. They both relate to Studying Pixels Plus, which is our Patreon program. And we said that we would donate all of the proceeds that we get from Studying Pixels Plus in March 2022 to Red Cross Ukraine. We're very happy to say that we did that. It actually happened. It's a small amount. I think it's around $50. But every little bit helps. And the thing is, I just read the news today, and it appears that Red Cross Ukraine is actively trying to reach into Mariupol, which is one of the surrounded cities that is completely crushed to dust, essentially. And that Red Cross is, at the moment, trying to get civilians out of there, trying to evacuate people. We hope that this donation and the donation that you have done by being a Studying Pixels Plus member, that might help, even if only a little bit. Of course, You also know that going forward, we always produce a monthly plus episode and we change it. Like every month, it's a new one. And this month, we've got another academic one for you because so many people struggle with coming up with a good research question. I know because I've just recently been correcting term papers again. You know, the winter term has ended. And you wouldn't believe how many term papers I look into and I immediately see either there is no research question whatsoever, the research question is too vague, it's just not well phrased, it's not well crafted. And the research question is at the same time one of the most important things of your term paper. If you want to write a term paper, the first thing you need is a proper research question. And that's why we recorded a whole plus episode on the question, what makes a good research question? So if you have any trouble with coming up with a good research question, or if you need help for future papers, talks, article publications, and so on, then this is a plus episode that you might want to listen to. I think it comes out next week, Wednesday, right? Always the first Wednesday of the month.
Yeah, and it'll be a nice listen, especially as I know in the US at least, we're coming up on final exam time, which means for all of you liberal arts students, you're going to be writing a lot of papers, so it's right in time.
It's your opportunity. And if you're curious about that, then you can go to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Before we dive into this, it may be worth staking one position, which is, I think we both agree, trans rights are human rights. We are both for the trans community. So everything we say moving forward, please understand that's where we're coming from. And I think as we dive into J.K. Rowling's positions, we find them to be pretty frustrating and I would say gross. That's my opinion on it at any rate. Yeah.
We might say some things, and even if it's only in quote throughout this episode, that might make certain people uncomfortable. I think you should be prepared if you're willing to listen to this conversation, because we want to have an open debate and we're going to talk about something controversial, right? Especially on social media, this matter of Hogwarts legacy is debated quite heatedly so, naturally because of its ties to J.K. Rowling. I basically came to propose this as a subject for an episode because recently there was a Sony State of Play that specifically focused on Hogwarts legacy. It showcased the central features of the game. You basically become a student in Hogwarts in the 1800s. You create your own student and then you explore an open world. You can explore Hogwarts itself, learn spells, make friends, and fight all kinds of monsters. It was something that when I saw it, I thought, wow, this actually looks really cool.
Yeah.
However, when you go online then, you notice that there is a weird silence on the matter. There are a lot of people, influencers, creators, podcasters, YouTubers, big video game outlets, who say we're categorically not going to cover or talk about this game. To be fair, most of the major outlets do. It is their job, and so they do, often with some kind of disclaimer. But many people do not. It seems that this hype train that Sony is trying to garner, and Warner Brothers, of course, which is the publisher of this game, is trying to garner, seems to be stalled at the station. And the reason for that is the stance of Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling on the matter of feminist discourse and especially trans identity. So we want to go through matters in a, let's say, relatively structured way, if we can. And that would mean that we first want to give you a little bit of context and our stance on the debate revolving around J.K. Rowling. We're then going to look into Hogwarts Legacy specifically. And ultimately, we're going to try and answer the question whether this game ought to be shunned or even to be boycotted. Starting off, J.K. Rowling.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. Let's go back to June 5th, 2020, a day where the perspective that people had on Harry Potter and the person that wrote it changed significantly because J.K. Rowling retweeted an article by the charity DevEx, which was titled as follows. Opinion: creating a more equal post-COVID-19 world for people who menstruate. End quote. That is the title of this article. We're not going to talk about the content of this article, but what J.K. Rowling really commented on was this phrase, for people who menstruate. Why doesn't this article just say women? Specifically, J.K. Rowling commented, quote, people who menstruate, I'm sure there used to be a word for those people. Someone help me out. Womben? Wimpunt? Womut? End quote. So she basically comes in with a rather sarcastic stance and pointing out that we ought not to abolish the idea of a woman and what a woman is. And then obviously she got some responses, some replies. And over the next couple of days, there were a whole lot of debates. There's one tweet that is often quoted, and I think that's quite indicative of what the stance was, because she then elaborated saying, I'm going to read out this tweet, quote, if sex isn't real, there's no same-sex attraction. If sex isn't real, the lived reality of women globally is erased. I know and love trans people, but erasing the concept of sex removes the ability of many to meaningfully discuss their lives. It isn't hate to speak the truth. End quote. So that's kind of the tweet that a lot of people got hung up on, I think.
And I think it shouldn't be understated how weird and out of left field this was, because if you read those tweets and you're familiar with the trans discourse, specifically the TERF discourse, which is trans exclusionary radical feminists, people who think that trans women are not women and that they're invading women's spaces. It's a hateful kind of rhetoric that they use. These tweets kind of raised alarms because it's, why is she talking like this? That sounds like something that these TERF people would say. And so that's what kind of kicked off this crazy discourse about where does she stand? What is she thinking? And so all of those tweets were dissected and looked at. I mean, they're still being looked at. We're looking at them now.
And yeah,
there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. But why is it, you just said, the TERF stance, the trans exclusionary radical feminist stance, is hateful. Why is that hateful? Can you explain that?
Yes. So, I should preface all of this. I'm by no means an expert, right? But from what I've gleaned from the discourse online, and I think I've followed it since this happened. Anytime something comes up, there's people on YouTube, both trans people and cis people, who talk about this quite a lot. My understanding is that so a TERF believes that a trans woman is not a woman, and therefore that stance in and of itself is transphobic, because if somebody is saying I am a woman, the stance should be so you are, right? That's your identity. But TERFs kind of take it in a hateful direction, basically by saying that trans women are men who are trying to invade women's spaces, either benignly or maliciously in worse cases. So it's this very prickly subject where they, first of all, come at it from a stance that trans women are not women, which is not true by all accounts. And it just kind of spirals from there. So to hear these sort of talking points from J.K. Rowling, somebody who, based on her work, seemed to be very inclusive and, you know, loving and open-minded, this, like I said, it just rose a lot of alarms for people, because all of a sudden she's using this kind of dog-whistly, hateful rhetoric pointing towards these TERF ideologies, which was frustrating and scary for a lot of people.
I must say, I struggle with this kind of utterance of trans women are women.
Mm.
I'll admit that. I struggle with that for different reasons than J.K. Rowling does, I suppose.
Mm.
The reason that I have, why I struggle with that, like, I get that it's a phrase, and I get that it's also an important thing to send a message. I do think that there is an ontological distinction between what we consider to be a woman and a trans woman. And I do think, now please don't hate me, I do think that that distinction is an important one, because it allows us to not only do what J.K. Rowling is insisting on, which is protecting women, but it also allows us to understand the specifics and the marginalization of trans people. Because if trans women were women in every way that matters, then that would, to me, say, okay, so there are no specific issues that we need to address revolving around the idea of being trans. So I do think it's good to, for the empowerment of trans identities, to maintain this distinction. However, and this is obviously where things get a little bit more intricate, the question is, what kind of significance should that ontological distinction have in the way that people are, you know, fairly treated, in the way that they have rights and access to spaces? That's, I think, what actually matters.
I absolutely take your point, because I think that trans people would agree with this point, at least to the point where you don't want to run into the erasure of trans issues, which, from my understanding, I mean, that's why we make the distinction between someone who is trans and someone who is cisgendered, right? Someone who is comfortable in the gender that they were assigned at birth. That's why that distinction exists. I think that the risk that we run when we talk in these, when we use this rhetoric that J.K. Rowling was using, is that you run into the TERF position, which is, not only we're not talking about the distinction between trans women and cis women, we are saying that trans women are not women, they are in fact men. And that is that's where the hateful portion of it comes into it.
That is absolutely wild. These claims that come up within the domain of J.K. Rowling from this discursive angle, they go into completely into absurd degrees. I engaged with this debate quite a bit, of course. I am very much involved in the matter of gender studies as well. And I do know that the question of, to which degree do physical bodies, to which degree does sex, right, the biological sex, matter?
Mm.
That is something that has been discussed in gender discourse for decades, right?
Yes.
This is something that, I mean, even Judith Butler, I'm going to quote her later on a little bit more, but Judith Butler is she was very influential in popularizing the idea that sex and gender are two different things, and that gender is like a social identity. However, she also said in her book, Gender Trouble, in 1990, I believe, that we do not have any access to an ontological, biological sex, but all our perspectives on the matter of sex are already gendered. Judith Butler is a radical constructivist, thus arguing that there is no way to possibly ascertain an objective reality that is not already part of our gender construction.
Right.
So this is a debate that's been going on in gender discourse for quite a while, which is why at first I was a little bit taken aback when when J.K. Rowling was was debated with such such passion, I would say.
Yeah, she came out hot.
She came out hot. Yeah,
yeah.
She hit the ground running.
Just gave everybody whiplash. It was like, wait a minute. What?
Yeah, and I thought, like, these are conversations that are being held in a much more nuanced and differentiated way within gender discourse already. Yeah. And now J.K. Rowling she comes in with a hammer. And this is very clear when she says something like, in the tweet that we read out before, if sex isn't real, there's no same-sex attraction. Yes, of course, you could say, well, if sex is not real, then technically you can't have a same-sex attraction. Thus, you cannot argue in favor of, let's say, people that identify or that are homosexual or that are lesbian, gay, you know? And that would obviously be a shame. However, what J.K. Rowling completely conflates, and this is something I would really like to stress, J.K. Rowling says, if sex isn't real... I don't think I've ever heard anyone argue that sex is not real. No. I've heard people argue that it's a construction. That's the radical constructivist view, is sex is a gendered construction. And a construction is very much real. It's not something that's just a hallucination or that's just random. Judith Butler, again, stressed this by writing a book titled Bodies That Matter, super intriguing read, by pointing out the limitations of, you know, let's say a completely fluid gender performance. And I do think we must understand, if we say something is a construction, that doesn't mean it's not real.
They go to, and when I say they, I mean people with TERF ideologies or transphobic ideologies, they go to these extreme places from the start where that's why that tweet was so jarring, because to see if sex isn't real, exactly as you said, Stefan, no one's saying that. No one is saying that.
Yeah.
No, we're saying that we need to take a look at the socially constructed aspect of these things and how that can be different, you know, depending on who you are and where you are and how you come to be. So it was just immediately strange to see these words coming from, not just J.K. Rowling. It would be, if anybody said this out of the blue, you'd say, oh, well, okay, you're showing me your true colors, I suppose. Yeah.
You want to know what the strangest thing is? The weirdest argument in all of this? You mentioned before that this kind of TERF position often includes the illusion of, I'm using quotation marks here, of men who basically pretend to be women entering female safe spaces and being a danger to women. This is an absolutely ludicrous argument for many reasons. The most important for me is that if we think of, let's say we think of a person, biological sex male, right? The assigned sex at birth male, who, let's say, gets a kick out of putting on women's clothes. Then that person has a kink, and we're not in the business of kink shaming, so, you know, do whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
But that is not a trans person. that's usually not what we mean when we talk about trans identities.
Right.
And when someone dresses up as a woman to enter, let's say, a female dressing room for women, to then harass or molest women, then that person is a sex offender, honestly.
Yes. First and foremost, I would say.
Exactly. First and foremost, a sex offender. And do you see what's happening there is that I saw this happening a lot with J.K. Rowling and with the things she's been retweeting and commenting on, this idea of the danger of female safe spaces being invaded, how it shifts the conversation. At one moment, we're talking about trans people and trans rights, trans identities, and suddenly the conversation has shifted and we're talking about sex offenders. And these are not the same thing. This is, I think, where the actual offense lies and where a lot of this intuitive anger comes from. It's because you implicitly equate trans people with people who either have a kink or people with people who are sex offenders who threaten women. And this is just neither empirically nor logically in any way reasonable to assume.
And I should say, too, that this is, it's a tale as old as time, right? This isn't new with transphobia, because this is a tactic used by homophobes as well, right? Conflating gay or lesbian people with sex offenders who are only out to indulge in some kind of heinous proclivity, right? And that's absolutely not the case. And you can see it happening with this kind of language for trans people too. So it's very important when a tweet like this comes out or a statement like this comes out, and you find that they are, people like J.K. Rowling are skipping points of an argument or taking things for granted or making these conflations, as you said, Stefan, they can be very dangerous and very hurtful. And that's why it's important to really see, what are you really saying here? Where are you coming from with your position? And I would say she's coming from a position of trans-exclusionary radical feminism and transphobia.
Yeah. The transphobia, for everyone who might struggle to understand this, the transphobia that I found very easy to identify is deliberately conflating sex offenders and trans identities. That is not the same thing. It's not the same conversation to have. I want to say that for everyone who has been, sexually harassed in a dressing room in such a way, there are cases where this happens before anyone says like, yeah, but it does happen. Fair enough. It does happen. It's a relatively rare crime. Obviously sexual harassment is not rare, but it is rare that someone dresses up as a woman and goes into a women's dressing room to harass people. That's statistically relatively rare. It's terrible if that happens, and we do need to fight in every way we can sexual harassment on all fronts as much as we can. But it's not concerning the matter of trans rights and trans identities. Those are two different conversations to be had, and I think understanding that and calling that out is one of the strongest arguments in my mind to identify where the issue is with J.K. Rowling's statements. Of course, this escalated very quickly, a whole lot long Twitter conversations, debates, and I found that two terrible things happened over time. One is J.K. Rowling became exceedingly entrenched in her stance, in, let's say, seemingly arguing in favor of protecting women, which is, as you say, then kind of modified into a trans-exclusionary argumentation. Also, so entrenched in this matter of transitioning and basically saying, like, when you go through J.K. Rowling's timeline, which I have done throughout the last couple of days in preparation of this episode.
What a wild ride.
I mean, I don't want to say, like, she also posts really good and really important things. I like that. I value when people are, you know, when famous people are politically engaged as well. But I want to say, aside from such posts like, you know, Freedom for Ukraine and things like that, a whole lot of things that she posts are all about how dangerous transitioning is. And this is a big problem because, transitioning can be a problem, just like it does happen that people dress up as, that men dress up as women and then try to harass them in a dressing room. These are things that do happen, but realistically, we have to say, if we look at the whole picture, then J.K. Rowling is basically giving a super one-sided perspective, only hammering down on these negative points. And that's what makes it so dangerous, because she's so actively campaigning with almost an obsessive degree.
Yes.
I was just shocked when I read through this. I thought, like, what? I think that's the same sensation that many people had when this all started. You think, like, what are you doing? It's like, just look at the other side a little bit and get an understanding of the whole picture, you know?
One thing it's pertinent to mention while we're talking about J.K. Rowling and these ideas is that she wrote a book called The Troubled Blood, which was under her pseudonym Robert Galbraith. And you mentioned, of course, that the slippery slope argument of these TERFs and the trans-exclusionary radical feminists is that they equate trans women to sex offenders. And that is what this book is about. It's about a serial killer who, I mean, basically, I think cross-dresses and enters women's restrooms or women's spaces and kills them and violates them. So she's been thinking about this for a while.
Yeah. And I think, as far as I know, she argued that she went down this rabbit hole of quote-unquote researching the matter of trans identities with, in the context of preparing for that book, right? That was according to her, that was the kickoff point for looking into this matter and getting engaged with this matter. It's interesting that she writes that book without, in the context of the discussion that we're having, you know? It's just a little bit strange. And what's even stranger is I stumbled upon the origin of this name, because the question is, of course, why the pseudonym Robert Galbraith? And I went to the website robertgalbraith.com, which is this pseudonym website where J.K. Rowling has also a Q&A. And she has a short section here where she elaborates on why the name Robert Galbraith. And she essentially says, quote, "I chose Robert because it's one of my favorite men's names, because Robert F. Kennedy is my hero, and because, mercifully, I hadn't used it for any of the characters in the Potter series or the casual vacancy. Galbraith came about for a slightly odd reason. When I was a child, I really wanted to be called Ella Galbraith, and I have no idea why. I don't even know how I knew the surname existed, because I can't remember ever meeting anyone with it." End quote. She continues on here to explain her intrigue in this name of Galbraith. She also mentions further below, quote, "Odder still, there was a well-known economist called J.K. Galbraith, something I only remembered by the time it was far too late. I was completely paranoid that people might take this as a clue and land at my real identity, but thankfully nobody was looking that deeply at the author's name." End quote. However, it also seems that J.K. Rowling either has not looked too deeply into the author's name, or that there is some intention in the fact that the name Robert Galbraith does exist and is connotated with psychiatry, with American psychiatry, and also with gay conversion therapy. We're talking here, if you want to look this up, we can link the Wikipedia article for a certain Robert Galbraith Heath, who, as the Wikipedia article says, quote, "During the course of his experiments in deep brain stimulation, Heath experimented with gay conversion therapy and claimed to have successfully converted a homosexual patient, labeled in his paper as patient B19. The patient, who had been arrested for marijuana possession, was implanted with electrodes into a septal region and many other parts of his brain. The septal electrodes were then stimulated while he was shown heterosexual pornographic material. The patient was later encouraged to have intercourse with a sex worker recruited for the study. As a result, Heath claimed the patient was successfully converted to heterosexuality." End quote. To be fair, in the 1950s, but this person is called Robert Galbraith Heath. And it's just, is that a coincidence, or has J.K. Rowling not sincerely not Googled that name? Because that's not a recent thing.
Right. Now, Stefan, if you or I were to pen a novel that was about a kind of serial killer who takes on a gender identity that is not their own to enact horrible things, I don't know, you might do a little research about the pseudonym that you're taking on. That is, you can attest to this, you saw it happen. I lost my mind when you told me that.
Yeah.
that is unreal. I can't believe that. That's so specific and such a particular name. I don't know if Galbraith is particularly common in the UK, but that, come on.
we can't know whether this is something that is intentional and where J.K. Rowling is basically, it's just part of constructing some kind of weird narrative around this entire idea of transphobia and, you know, being, and also in this case, very homophobic. Yeah. However, it might also be that maybe she just really didn't look into it and didn't do proper research. In either case, really, if you pick such a pseudonym, such a specific name, as you said, like Robert Galbraith, you want to Google it, and it's not hard. If you Google Robert Galbraith, this is something that pops up relatively, like, let's say, on the first three pages, for sure, of Google.
And
I don't know. I find it befuddling, and I find that this entire conversation revolving around J.K. Rowling, the deeper you get into this, the more you can't help to realize how problematic it actually is, the way she's entrenching in this, doubling down, and seems to be completely resistant to any kind of argumentation.
This is not a case of someone who misunderstood a position or was ill-informed or uneducated on something. I can promise you, J.K. Rowling has been educated on this six ways to Sunday. She knows what she's talking about at this point. So this is something where she is deeply, deeply rooted to this position. And that puts a kind of pall over her work. Because now you know where it's coming from. It's not a misunderstanding. This is how she feels.
Yeah, it's not like the information is not available. It's not like people have not tried to convince
billions of times.
Yes, billions of times. And it's been a futile endeavor. And the thing is, though, on the other hand, I do want to say, we mentioned already, like when it comes to the death of the author, when it comes to hate, there's also a whole another conversation on the terrible things that J.K. Rowling has also been confronted with in the context of this. I'm not talking about the arguments, and even if you want to argue fiercely, that's perfectly fine. But of course, she has also faced a whole lot of hate, actual hate and threats of violence, death threats. This is in absolutely no way acceptable. One thing that I found really shocking throughout these last few weeks as I've been engaging with this and reading up on the entire thing is that it seems to be insulting J.K. Rowling as a person seems to have become kind of a self-evident thing. I listened to a podcast where exactly the question that we are discussing right now has also been discussed. It was the Kind of Funny Games cast, by the way. I don't usually listen to that one, but I found the topic interesting. And there, one of the hosts mentioned that, J.K. Rowling is a piece of shit on Twitter.
Mm.
In other ways, on Reddit, various things happen on Reddit, but I found a whole subreddit where people were talking about, you know, the question of a threat, where people were talking about Hogwarts Legacy, and where J.K. Rowling was only called, quote, that bitch, end quote, by everyone. This is a problem. We can't dehumanize J.K. Rowling, no matter how disagreeable, offensive, or terrible we would find her stance. Attack the argument, not the person. Don't do this ad hominem fallacy. It will only escalate the debate further.
And a through line of our podcast is that we condemn a lot of these arguments, and we don't like the kind of rabbit holes that we have to go down when we're explaining things like this. But you said in our very first episode, a really good way to have the person you're arguing against sink their talons into whatever they're stuck to is to make them into a villain. And I would say that she is certainly committing villainous acts, but she's still a person and doesn't deserve violent death threats for this. I do understand where it's coming from, the frustration and the feeling of betrayal that a lot of people have, or the shaking your head at her digging her claws into this, but violence is just not any answer to any issue.
Exactly. Instead, if it's okay, I would like to round off this particular conversation on the J.K. Rowling matter by some really inspiring words that I found, again, written by Judith Butler in an interview with The Guardian. This is just from 2021. And Judith Butler spoke about exactly this matter of trans-exclusionary radical feminism and trans rights. And Judith Butler said, quote, "Politically securing greater freedoms for women requires that we rethink the category of women to include those new possibilities. The historical meaning of gender can change as its norms are reenacted, refused, or recreated. So we should not be surprised or opposed when the category of women expands to include trans women. And since we are also in the business of imagining alternate futures of masculinity, we should be prepared, and even joyous, to see what trans men are doing with the category of men." End quote. This is Judith Butler, and I must say, I very much agree with this, and I think that while I said at the beginning it's might be for the sake of identity politics important to maintain the understanding of specific trans issues, that does not mean that we can't widen the concept of what a woman is to include trans women.
Absolutely. I think leave it to Judith Butler, I think, to put a cap on that conversation.
Yes. So let's move on and talk about what we actually came here to talk about, which is Hogwarts Legacy.
Yes. So that's the background.
So that's the background. An important one, though, because I thought it's just good to give this conversation a little bit of time. But we're going to get into the actual meat of Hogwarts Legacy now, because in September 2020, Warner Brothers Interactive announced a game that had already been leaked years prior, Hogwarts Legacy. It's developed by Avalanche Software, a studio that mostly made Disney license games. I found that they made such things like Disney Infinity. They made a couple of Cars games. I'm not sure what that actually says about the quality to be expected from Hogwarts Legacy.
That's a pin in it for another time.
They're definitely going into a whole new direction. And they released this game under the framework of Portkey Games. That is the label that encompasses the Wizarding World license. So that's a license that J.K. Rowling owns. And it's kind of the lore, the entire universe of everything that happens with Harry Potter and the Fantastic Beasts and so on and so forth, right? And the thing is, they had quite some issues aside from what we've already debated. For example, there was one developer as part of Hogwarts Legacy, Troy Leavitt is his name. He left the studio in February 2021 because he posted some videos on his private YouTube channel that were politically provocative. And I want to say this, it's I reported on that matter back then at a different podcast. And I here am also a bit startled when people say that, yeah, he's a Nazi, or he's like a alt-right dude. He is conservative, certainly, and his views can be disagreed with. And I think, for the most part, I disagreed with almost everything that he said. I watched a couple of his YouTube videos. Not all of them back in the day, but a couple. But I didn't find anything in there that I would deem to be hateful or to be particularly racist. I disagree with it, right? I don't want to endorse his YouTube channel.
Sure.
But he's not a Nazi. So this is one issue that basically happened that already drew some controversy on this matter. And over time, of course, people started to debate the matter of trans identities caused by J.K. Rowling's Twitter ramblings, I'm going to call them.
Very charitable of you, yeah.
When information was leaked by Jason Schreier, sorry, it was not leaked by Jason Schreier, but reported on by Jason Schreier from people at the studio, who said in a Bloomberg article, quote, "When players start up the game, they will be able to create a character that has a masculine or feminine voice, no matter what their body looks like, according to people familiar with the game's development. Players will then get to select one of two options, witch or wizard. that will determine the dorm they get placed in at the magical school of Hogwarts, and how they are addressed by other characters in the game. End quote. So the idea is that Hogwarts Legacy might, this is a rumor, I haven't got a confirmation for that. I reached out to Warner Brothers and I asked them, I said, like, is this real? We'd like to really know, because we're doing a podcast discussing this matter and it would kind of be important for our position.
Yeah.
I have not heard back.
No response.
much to my surprise, they have not responded to my email.
But yeah, we tried.
We have to treat it as a rumor for now, if a fairly likely one at that, that you may be able to create a trans character in Hogwarts Legacy. Presumably as a response to the entire discourse revolving around J.K. Rowling.
This is where the gray area comes into it, right? Because I think that would be something that would be certainly good to include, this sort of trans option for creating your character. But I can already hear the online discourse saying, well, that's just you trying to cover yourself here, you know?
Yeah.
To kind of get some good boy and girl points from doing the right thing. And I don't know. It seems like you're kind of in a position where you can't really win, although I do think it's a nice gesture.
I do think it is probably a corporate attempt to appease people who might be concerned about Hogwarts Legacy, because
yeah,
it is in fact the case that if you purchase Hogwarts Legacy, then that will be a certain amount of money going to J.K. Rowling. We don't know what the exact deal is. It might be that she has already been paid, or it might be that she gets paid regardless. I assume she probably does. I assume that you basically rent out you purchase a license, basically, or make a license agreement, and that J.K. Rowling gets paid anyway. But there might be some kind of bonus involved when the game sells extra well or something like that. We don't know about these details. But you will definitely be, to a certain degree, no matter how small, also aiding J.K. Rowling. And she might then, as she does, also double down on her stance on campaigning against transitioning and fear-mongering revolving around this idea of transitioning, which is a proper issue.
Again, the gray area here is like saying, well, she already has more money than the Queen. Right. And so you think,
and she does.
Yeah. And how much of this is really affecting her daily activity on Twitter? And you think, well, maybe not that much, but I do think it's a principle for a lot of people that we don't have a lot of options when it comes to affecting change. But one of the biggest options we have is deciding where our wallet goes. And it is definitely impactful if there's a big enough boycott on this game that maybe a message gets through to her, or at the very least, further messages don't get out from her.
I think the most likely scenario, if it happens, let's say, hypothetically speaking, a lot of people were to say, I'm not going to play this game. Let's say there's a systematic boycott. And not a single copy gets sold, right?
Yeah.
Very unlikely to happen, but hypothetically speaking, worst case scenario for the developers and publishers, not a single copy gets sold. That might mean that the Harry Potter license as such basically becomes a complete red flag. That would mean that we would probably not see any more investments into at least the attempt to make video games about Harry Potter. We'll see Fantastic Beast films and so on. People continue making Harry Potter stuff and funny apps and so on. But it might be that they just like, whoa, okay, on this level of, you know, video game culture, gamers are woke.
Yeah, pump the brakes. We got woke gamers.
Pump the brakes. Hold all developments. And it's also, I must say, it's also a very emotional matter. We asked, obviously, on social media for input from you to see what your perspectives are. And Tu Nguyen commented and said, yes, we should shun Hogwarts Legacy, not planning on playing it. quote, "I will admit that it looks exactly what I've been wanting in a Harry Potter game, and it would have made kid me probably very happy. But alas, Harry Potter is not important to me anymore. Also, thanks to the author," end quote. So I think apart from a rational consideration of the harms and benefits, let's say the utilitarian calculus, it's also just a matter of emotion. So many people enjoyed Harry Potter and then came to realize that the person that basically creatively authored this entire world has some worldviews that they find highly problematic. It's a deep disappointment that you fall into. And then you look at your bookshelf and you see like Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, J.K. Rowling, and you feel immediately reminded, oh yeah, you know, don't transition and, you know, this kind of fear-mongering. And you might intuitively just not want to engage with that, you know?
Well, I think that's why the death of the author argument is so worth discussing in this case, because I remember back in 2020 when this originally started, and I'm sorry, I'm just remembering now that I saw this YouTube video, so I don't remember who created it, but the sentiment was really beautiful in it, which was, it was a long video kind of going through all of this discourse, and at the end of it, this guy had said that, you know, Harry Potter doesn't belong to her anymore. It's ours at this point. And that's a sentiment that I share with all art. Once it's out in the world, if the artist is still around, it's interesting to get their take on things from time to time. Quick sidebar to plug David Lynch in our ongoing celebration of David Lynch. Fix your hearts or die, everybody. He says that once an idea is out there, it's up to everyone. It's a beautiful idea. It belongs to everyone, right? And I think that it's important to consider Death of the Author as a framework, because there are plenty of people who Harry Potter is very important to, and they are at odds with this position that J.K. Rowling has taken. And so, like Antu had said, it's not important to her anymore. It's kind of, it's had her attention and now that's gone. But there are plenty of people who are struggling with, I love Harry Potter, I love the characters, I love the world, and it's tainted by J.K. Rowling, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is also, but legally she does own it. Like,
oh yeah.
The argument of death of the author is largely a theoretical one, because
yes,
effectively that's hers. It's literally her belonging.
Still, yeah, to this day. I mean, that's the problem, right? You can easily say death of the author was Shakespeare because he's not around and he doesn't own anything anymore.
But yeah.
J.K. Rowling is still, she's tweeting every day. So
you just think why not let trans people have the conversation, you know? Why?
Yeah.
Why?
What do you... This is where we both break down and we get rid of all of the debate terminology. And we're like, what are you doing?
But maybe to bring it back to exactly that argument of the death of the author, Der Grigat went to our Twitter account, our Instagram account, and said the following, referring to Roland Barthes' death of the author, "It is not important anymore what J.K. Rowling's intentions were while creating the Wizarding World. What each individual reader interprets is much more important. Many people have found a safe space behind the walls of the beloved castle of Hogwarts. Considering that Rowling is not involved in the production of Hogwarts Legacy, it would be unfair to shun the game and the ideas of the whole creative team behind it just because J.K. Rowling made some questionable statements," end quote.
The real sticking point, and I think why my position hasn't really changed, is because there is still that financial tie to her. So regardless of her involvement, she is benefiting from this, right? But that's a very good argument right there, that it's out of her hands. This, especially Hogwarts Legacy, which is created by a whole team of people that are not her.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. By a whole team of people that are not her. And as we received in another comment by Dead Drop Podcast on Instagram, quote, "If the studio comes out with harassment claims, sure, that is, we should shun them. However, they've distanced themselves from J.K. Rowling pretty far. And if the community welcomes all, that would be an important thing," end quote. Mm. So yes, in the sense of the death of the author argument, I would add to that, while she legally owns the wizarding world and while she makes money on it, she's so rich. We said several times money's meaningless, basically, at that scale.
Yes. It's our catchphrase.
Yeah, Studying Pixels, money is meaningless.
Money is meaningless. Please donate to Studying Pixels Plus.
Well, it depends on to whom it is meaningless. Yes, those people that have a lot of it. And that's the thing. J.K. Rowling has so much money that for her, it is completely immaterial how this game does and whether she makes money from that particular license contract or not, which she surely will anyway. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any difference, none, or a very marginal difference that I would argue is negligible, considering that on the other hand, it is an opportunity to show to her and to the world that a game or a fiction in the context of the wizarding world, of the Harry Potter lore, is possible, that specifically includes trans identities and does not avoid speaking about them or is weird about them. We have to see how it's implemented, but the promise is there. The potential is there. And wouldn't that be beautiful? To basically, it would almost be a way to spite the original author by saying, look, we've created this and it's a much more inclusive and engaging fiction because we don't deliberately exclude people from it.
That's a good segue into my closing thoughts, maybe, because that I do think that we should not shun this game. I will not personally be playing it for a number of reasons, chief among them, I don't know that I'm that interested in Harry Potter. I think I maybe share Antu's, it's not that important to me anymore kind of feeling. So I'm not going to be playing it. I'm not going to be buying it, but I don't think that we should shun it, because this is created by an entire team of people who are working very hard on it. They're putting their labor into it. And what's uplifting to me about this is exactly as you said, this may be a first step in the direction of reclaiming this piece of art for people that are not J.K. Rowling. So it's so important to so many people. Maybe if we take those ideas that are important to all of those people, like being inclusive with trans people, that this will start to, Harry Potter will start to move away from J.K. Rowling and her kind of stain on it, at least in a very small way. And that to me is a little bit uplifting. So I don't think we should shun it. I just won't be engaging with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'm going to wait to see what the reviews say to see whether I'm going to play this. I think so far, it seemed really cool. And I'm going to be honest, just a couple of weeks ago, I rewatched the Harry Potter films. You know, maybe I'm just a cold-hearted person. But honestly, the thing is, the Harry Potter fiction, if you are, well, to be fair, I am in a privileged position because I'm not directly affected by what J.K. Rowling is saying. I'm only affected by extension because I care. And because I can't stand when people are, you know, just completely distorting arguments or are not at all reasonable in the way they argue. But I'm privileged. I belong to a very privileged group in the society. And that's why maybe it's arrogant to say I can allow myself to engage with this. But on the other hand, I want to stress that the reason why I don't have a problem with rewatching Harry Potter films is because I love that world and because there is so much in there of virtue and value. It's also a decisively anti-fascist fiction, I might say. There are problems with Harry Potter. There are problems that also are discussed in the case of Hogwarts Legacy, such as anti-Semitic stereotypes in the case of the goblins that maintain the banks. You know, that's an issue.
Whole other podcast. Yeah.
That's a whole other podcast. But to be fair, this is something that does matter, and it's something that we need to discuss, ideally when the game comes out. And it's also something that is very predominant in fantasy. Like, if that is the case, then cancel J.R.R. Tolkien as fast as you possibly can. because that thing, yeah. that world is infused with racism.
Yeah.
So Harry Potter does make, I think, I like the anti-fascist ideology that that is basically residing within it, and obviously the strong statements on the matters of friendship and compassion, dedication, and so on. There are a whole lot of virtues that I relate to, and that's why I like it. And that's why I might also play this game. I don't think we should shun it, because it gives us the opportunity to create a fiction that is more inclusive and thus more enjoyable than what J.K. Rowling might originally have had in mind.
Beautifully said.
Then with that, we're going to end that conversation here. But of course, that doesn't mean that we've settled things. We're going to have to observe how things will continue. And obviously, we're very curious to hear what you think of our debate, of the general debate. Please let us know what you think by going to our social media accounts and just, you know, tweeting out at us, or going to studyingpixels.com/contact, where you can also shoot us a brief email. And while you do so, we're going to go ahead and do some side questing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As you know, in our side quests, we venture through the internet and bring you stories and articles that we find interesting and relevant. We also share our own impressions of games we are currently playing, and of course, you can find all the links that we reference in the show notes. Number one.
E3 is dead. Long live E3.
as always, as it's been for many years now.
Yes, although maybe more seriously this time, because as Rebecca Valentine tells us from IGN, E3 2022 had been canceled in person, but the ESA came out, the group that puts the E3 together, and they said that there will not be a digital equivalent either. So E3 2022 is effectively canceled for this year.
So, and now we're all thinking, why?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. Obviously, the pandemic contributes to it. But I think reading kind of between the lines a little bit, maybe this is a portent of things to come. So I'm just going to read very quickly. This is a quick statement in this article. The ESA had initially planned for an in-person E3 event this year after having no event in 2020 due to COVID-19 and a digital one in 2021. However, this was canceled in January, with the ESA at the time unable to make a public statement on whether or not there would be a digital equivalent. According to sources speaking to IGN at the time, discussions around D3 had been fraught throughout the year, with third parties normally involved finding the ESA's ongoing silence regarding their plans frustrating. So, unclear. Obviously, the pandemic threw a wrench into big public events, but it also seems like there is some disruption among the ranks with third parties and probably even the major developers, where they all, I mean, Nintendo, Sony, they all have their own showcases. And you do kind of wonder, between this and things like the Game Awards, what is E3 really doing?
What is E3 doing? And of course, when it comes to being frustrated with not getting word from them on whether anything is going to happen and in what form, then we have to keep in mind that these are actually things that require a lot of preparation on the side of publishers and developers, because often at such events like E3, these things are seen as milestones where, you know, certain steps in the development of a game have to be taken, where a vertical slice of the game has to be created or a demo has to be available. And often the public response that then follows these announcements will influence the future of the development of that game. So for a studio, it is very important that they know well in advance, ideally half a year in advance, I would say,
yeah,
whether an E3 is going to happen and when exactly, so they know what to go towards. If you then think like, okay, now it's 2 months, and even if it were to happen now, we can't really show anything that we haven't shown before or that's not already slated for another event, then you suddenly end up and you do an E3, but present what, you know?
Right. And I think that If I were a representative from one of those companies, I would be pretty taken aback by the silence. That's a huge deal. I mean, a couple of months out at this point, as you say, a lot of prep work goes into these presentations. So it's as if, I don't know, to put it in academic terms, it's as if your professor assigns the final exam 2 days before it's due, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, I don't want to deal with this kind of hassle. So it's not happening this year, although the ESA has shared an official statement talking about their plans for next year. So they do see, this isn't, as of now, this isn't a permanent cancellation of E3. They say, quote, "We will devote all our energy and resources to delivering a revitalized physical and digital E3 experience next summer," meaning 2023. "Whether enjoyed from the show floor or your favorite devices, the 2023 showcase will bring the community, media, and industry back together in an all-new format and interactive experience. We look forward to presenting E3 to fans around the world live from Los Angeles in 2023. Best of luck, lads. I don't know.
Best of luck.
I don't know what that looks like, but
as you already said, pretty much every major publisher has their own showcases, mm-hmm. and I do see value in E3, because it is a problem when all of these different publishers, they basically are fragmented and separate into their own communities. Like in a state of play, Sony or PlayStation is communicating with people that are already fans of PlayStation. Whereas at an E3, you have the opportunity to speak kind of to the wider video game community. Mm. We need such places and such events that bring the video game community or video game culture as such together. I would sincerely appreciate if that would work. I don't know whether it will, considering that things, as you said, such as the Game Awards, the Game Awards, I feel, have in the last, let's say, 2 years at least, largely replaced the function of E3, because the Game Awards are, of course, an award show. But at the same time, at least to 50%, maybe even 60%, they are an announcement show of new games, such as E3 always had been, right?
Yeah, and I think I'm just thinking from an economic standpoint, or I suppose an economical standpoint. If I'm Mr. Microsoft, or if I'm Mr. Sony, and I say, well, do we really want to put in the effort and the money into putting together an E3 presentation if we're going to have our own presentation, plus we're going to get representation at the Game Awards? You know, it just seems like, why do we really, at this point, why do we need E3? In past years, as you said, it was a way to reach out to a broader audience, but I don't think a company like Nintendo or Sony or any of the big players really needs that at this point.
Well, Nintendo is just like, let's make a 20-minute presentation about an Animal Crossing DLC.
where Aonuma-san apologizes for Breath of the Wild 2 again.
Yeah. And shows a Metroid logo.
There you go.
Please be excited. Okay, number two, things are really shifting. All new PlayStation Plus launches in June with 700-plus games and more value than ever.
Wow.
This is, by the way, it's not a statement by me. This was the title of the press release by PlayStation.
Fair point to make.
I would not say that. There's the writing by Jim Ryan. Of course, as everyone knows, it's been no secret that PlayStation Plus has been lagging behind other subscription services such as Xbox Game Pass for quite a while now. Mm. Xbox has been super dedicated to making its Game Pass an absolute priority, available on as many platforms as possible. Whereas PlayStation, it seems still to be tied to a rather conventional model of basically putting high production value games at the front of their business. Now, on March 29th, Sony announced its rework of PlayStation Plus. This had long since been rumored that they would make substantial changes. And so they have, getting up the hopes of, by, I think that was December last year, 48 million subscribers worldwide. The key idea is to integrate PlayStation Plus with PlayStation Now. PlayStation Now is the cloud streaming service where you can register and then you can cloud stream PS3, like older games, classic games, up to PS4 games. From June this year onward, PlayStation Plus will be layered in three tiers. There's going to be an essential tier, that's the first one. There you basically have no changes. This is identical to what you get at the moment when you have PlayStation Plus. So two monthly downloadable games, exclusive discounts, cloud storage for saved games, online multiplayer access, and all of that at $10 per month or $60 per year. Then there's PlayStation Plus Extra, which is the second tier. They say, quote, adds a catalog of up to 400 of the most enjoyable PS4 and PS5 games, including blockbuster hits from our PlayStation Studios catalog and third-party partners. Games in the Extra tier are downloadable for play. This Extra tier comes at a price upgrade of, I'm only going to say the annual fee now, right? Of $100. So the Essential is 60, the Extra is 100. And the third one is Premium, which comes at 120 and includes another 340 games, mostly classic games, apparently. The ability to cloud stream, so to basically use what has previously been known as PlayStation Now, and some time-limited trials for new games, where you can just go onto the store and say, I would like to play Ghostwire Tokyo for half an hour before I decide whether I want to buy it or not. Mm. They say, to conclude this story, quote, the new Extra and Premium tiers represent a major evolution for PlayStation Plus. With these tiers, our key focus is to ensure that the hundreds of games we offer will include the best quality content that sets us apart. At launch, we plan to include titles such as Death Stranding, God of War, Marvel's Spider-Man Miles Morales, Mortal Kombat 11, and Returnal. We're working closely with our imaginative developers from PlayStation Studios and third-party partners to include some of the best gaming experiences available with a library that will be regularly refreshed. More details to come on the games we'll have on our new PlayStation Plus service. End quote. Now the question is this a good deal? Is it the right decision to rework PlayStation Plus in this particular way? Does that appeal to you, Dan?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm probably going to try the premium service.
Oh yeah.
I think so, because we always joke about how we're big Sony fanboys, and I grew up playing a ton of PlayStation classic games and PlayStation 2. So if those are available, I think that'll be a huge draw for someone like me. I'm also coming at it from the perspective of Game Pass does it right by keeping these games somewhere where you can have access to them, because it's difficult to find certain games physically. Maybe you don't have the hardware, etc., etc. So I appreciate the work going into having a library of these games. That being said, it does seem kind of scarce, and I know that there's problems with the PS3 streaming. It seems like it's only available for streaming. There's some issue there where
yes.
Sony doesn't understand its own hardware or something.
Exactly. Yeah. That's I think the issue. The PS3, they made this weird decision of going with a completely different processor unit, and it basically just completely messed things up for generations to come. So by now they are like, we can't emulate PS3 games. We can only stream them.
Great. Well, I mean, at least they're available in some form, I suppose, but that seems silly. But I am definitely for this. And I think maybe I'll rethink it when we have a full list, just to see what's available and what might be in the future. But I think generally speaking, $60 to $120 a year with access to that many games does seem appealing to me.
It does seem appealing. What I find curious, though, is that what they did not do is copy the Xbox Game Pass model. Because one of the strongest arguments in favor of the Xbox Game Pass is that if you subscribe to the Ultimate Xbox Game Pass, then you get every single new Xbox first-party title immediately at launch, free, basically. Included in your subscription. I always think it's not free, really. It's part of your subscription. Sony does not do that. And I thought about why. And I think what Sony is trying to do here is, the thing is, Sony relies a lot more on exclusive titles than Xbox does. Xbox, of course, they've purchased a whole lot of studios now, so they've really boosted up their library. But Sony is still known for its exclusives, for titles such as The Last of Us, Uncharted, right? Returnal. Right. There's so many, too many titles to name them all here, but God of War, of course. That is an exclusive, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It is an exclusive. I think it's available on other platforms as well, but always
on,
that happens.
It's
always
on
later.
PC, but yeah, on it's, PC. It's a Sony title for sure.
Just like Horizon and Spider-Man and so on.
Yeah.
Now, I think that might actually be a smart decision, because the thing is, if you say that all of these games, imagine all of these high-profile PlayStation exclusives, praised for their quality as they are released at no additional charge for people who have this, let's say, premium subscription of $120 a year. That might not make economic sense, because I think, as is most likely, people who have such a plus subscription and who play on PlayStation, they probably buy more than two of these exclusives at roughly the launch window a year, so it's really not financially viable, and it also kind of devalues these exclusives a little bit, because that means if you have a thing, this is kind of the Apple mentality, right? Where you say, we do this thing, it's going to be really great, you have to purchase it, you have to buy an X, you know, you have to put some money into this, you have to purchase it for $70, but then you'll get access to this fantastic thing that we ensured has a super high quality. I think it's kind of also a matter of status.
I think so. Especially because those big titles that are Sony exclusives, we don't get a dozen of those a year. They feel like big events. So I think it's apt to compare it to an Apple unveiling, because it is like, this is the Sony game this year. You know, get excited for it. We're going to have this whole hype train behind it. So I agree with you. And I think that price tag definitely is maybe a little jarring, but it sounds like they're trying to implement enough games to make it worth your while.
Yeah, I think for me, I might stay on Essential for now, because the thing is that the good thing about this is you can basically change tiers, as far as we are aware, on a monthly basis. It's like a Netflix thing, I suppose.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like I have so many games to play. I'm still playing Elden Ring at the moment. And if you ask me in 2 months, I'll probably still be playing Elden Ring. So it's like I'll stay on Essential. And then once I'm in the situation where I say, okay, now I really want to get into that library, or maybe there's some really cool games. For example, I've never played, can you believe that I've never played Metal Gear Solid?
I would say yes, because it's such an impenetrable game. So I know what you're saying, but also yes, I believe that.
I'd love to. The only problem is there's no easy way to do that, you know?
Yeah.
There's no easy way to play through all of the Metal Gear, or at least all of the Metal Gear Solid games. So if that is part of such a tier, let's say premium tier or extra tier, then I might be able to say, okay, I'm going to subscribe to it for a couple of months to get that. Still, one more statement, just because I can't bear it anymore. Cloud storage for saved games should not be part of a Plus subscription. It should not. The thing is, with previous console generations, with PS3 and PS4 games, you could save those save games on a USB stick and basically copy it over in case you, for example, had to reset your console. You can get all these save games of games you're currently playing, copy it on a USB stick, and then put it back on the console once you've reset it or had to repair it. PS5 games, curiously, do not allow that. Not at all. There is, as far as I'm aware, no way you can back up your save files without entering a Plus subscription. And while I understand that makes you a whole lot of money, it is not nice and exploitative. So don't do that. You know, make it a free feature to have at least the option to back up all of your save games. That's not... Or at least give us the option to copy it on a USB drive.
Yeah, at the very least.
It had to be said. Number three...
Yes, in the continuing amazing year for video games, I'm playing Ghostwire Tokyo right now, and I'm having so much fun with it. It is the new game from Bethesda, and it's about ghosts in Tokyo.
Don't say.
Yeah.
What a misleading title.
I know, yeah. So the plot from 10,000 Feet is that you play as a character named Akito, and Akito is caught in the middle of a ghost invasion in Shibuya, and he nearly dies, but he is possessed by a person who has recently died, who has these magical powers named Keke. And so they work together to fight these ghosts and right the wrongs that are happening in this world from the invaders that are coming in and trying to manipulate death and make our world a living hell, basically. And I will say that the story is simple, but the characters are great. They're immediately engaging. You know exactly who they are from the start. You get very close to them very quickly. And the gameplay is fun, although it is a bit repetitive. There's a lot of skill acquisition that you can use, but it's an open world in Shibuya, and there's a lot of collecting. And there's a lot of same enemy types. So that does get repetitive. But I will say what is keeping me going is, without question, how Tokyo looks in this game. Mm. You can walk through the greater part of Shibuya. It is so accurate in certain places. I found a street where I used to get ramen. And I was so excited.
Aw, that's amazing. Yeah. I was about to ask that because you've been there. Yeah. You know the place. And you felt like you were properly transported there.
Yes. It's definitely like they take liberties here and there. But there are certain landmarks and streets. Like I can tell you, when you go to Shibuya Crossing, you'll immediately recognize Persona 5 landmarks. You know, it's very clear that they modeled this after the real place. And It is so fun to explore. You have a lot of freedom, and it's a little jarring going to it from Elden Ring because it has those kind of Ubisoft open world hallmarks of finding places and opening up the map. But it's so fun to walk around, and it's scary at times. It's surprising. So it does feel a little bit worth it. So I'm about halfway through it right now. I can't wait to finish it. And I don't know that I'll get to platinum on it because it's a lot of collecting, but I definitely have been enjoying the time I've sunk into it.
It might be that the collecting and the gameplay repetition, that's what I've heard so far, that they kind of drain you over time. But I think the big question that is probably going to be the decisive matter on whether someone should jump into Ghostwire Tokyo is, how intrigued are you into, you know, basically experiencing the atmosphere of Shibuya?
It's great. And there's a lot of really creepy imagery. I will say that what's not repetitive, and actually this is a testament to the game, because a lot of these Assassin's Creed type open world games, the side quests are, it's just generic, and you have to just check a box. Maybe there's a mission where you follow somebody or a mission where you collect something. All the side missions in Ghostwire Tokyo are unique and interesting and a really great look into yurei and yokai lore, you know, ghosts and demons. That's a lot of fun with it. So as repetitive as the collecting is, the actual story content is really rich.
Now, I've got a question. Just one single thing that I saw from Ghostwire Tokyo is a sequence in which you do a side quest for a ghost that is on a public toilet and they don't have toilet paper.
Yeah.
Now, I remember I did a lengthy side quest in Yakuza where the exact same thing happened. Is that something? Is that an actual issue that so many games draw from that? Is that like a big social issue or something?
It's just, I guess it's shorthand for empathy. I don't know. but I had the exact same thought because I did that the other day, and I thought, is this guy going to ask me for 20 more tissues as I walk around Shibuya?
I thought maybe there's some kind of like, it's a cultural thing that it's like a big fear or something that you're stuck on a public toilet with no, I mean, it is a fear.
It is
terrible.
A fear, yeah.
It is terrible all around the world, but I thought it was maybe a specific thing like that constantly happens to people in Tokyo or something.
Not that I know of, although I wouldn't be too surprised. I will say, the last thing I'll say about it is, as repetitive as the enemy types are, the first time you see them is always really effective. When you see a new one, like there's the lady with the red umbrella, whose yokai name I'm forgetting right now, but it's really effectively creepy. And, you know, eventually she shows up as just another enemy, but the first time you see them as the big bad, it's really cool. So it does a lot of things right. It's just a little monotonous, but I'm enjoying it very much.
I'm looking forward to jump into it once I have completed my never-ending journey in Elden Ring and my never-ending journey in Horizon Zero
Horizon.
Dawn.
Yeah.
Horizon Forbidden West.
It's the year of, it's a good problem to have this year. I think we're spoiled with good games so far.
It's fine. It's so cold here at the moment. It's actually, can you imagine the April 1st, I wake up in the morning, it's like -2 degrees Celsius, naturally.
Yeah.
There's snow outside my window right now.
Yep. Ah, spring.
It feels
spring
like,
in Germany.
It feels like this is like, it could be Christmas next week.
Yep. Well, hopefully we're getting out of that soon, because it'd be nice to have some warmth.
Ah, save Elden the snow. Thank you so very much for listening. If you are curious about this show and you want to follow up and engage with us, then you can go to studyingpixels.com/contact, where you can send us an email, you can reach out on social media, or you can fill out a contact form, and guess what? It will actually reach us and we'll read your message. We're looking forward to hear from you, and we'll talk again next week. Bye bye.
Hold up.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.